Media Masters with Paul Blanchard.
Welcome to Media Masters, a series of one-to-one interviews with people at the top of the media game. Today I'm joined by the journalist and politician Lord Daniel Finkelstein. Daniel started his career in policy development, leading both the Social Market Foundation and Policy Exchange. A political advisor to Prime Minister John Major and William Hague, he was director of Conservative Research Department between 1997 and 1999 and was one of the earliest advocates of Tory party modernisation. He joined The Times as leader writer in 2001 and quickly ascended through the ranks, becoming comment editor, chief leader writer and executive editor for digital, and also helped launch the paper's online opinion section, Comment Central. Winner of Political Commentator of the Year, Daniel is a well-known columnist writing about politics and football, regularly appears on political shows such as The Daily Politics and Newsnight, and was made a Conservative peer in 2013. Danny, thank you for joining me.
Pleasure.
Now, just before we started recording, we were having a bit of a chit-chat and you agreed with me that you're one of the few remaining Blairites, is that right?
Well, it was a slightly puckish point. The irony is that the people who admire Tony Blair, I think most of those people are probably not in the Labour Party, either because they've left with Corbyn becoming the leader or because they were never members because Tony Blair had begun to appeal to a centre-right audience. When I read The Journey, I was very struck by how much of it I agreed with. There were two things in it that I had a problem with. First of all, he's too enthusiastic about the European Union. And the second was, I think he believes that you should kind of lock up people before you've taken them to court, whereas I sort of think a due process of law would be a good idea. So there was a kind of two different points on which I differed with him, but the rest of it was remarkably similar to my politics. And I thought, is that my problem or his? I conclude really it's actually his problem. I think that when people on the left said they thought Tony Blair was a Tory, well, I think he actually did come quite close to being a liberal conservative, and certainly I've got a lot of sympathy for quite a lot of things that he believes in and for him personally.
Because you actually started your political career with the SDP, didn't you? You were an advisor to David Owen.
I was. Well, maybe advisor makes me sound more important than I was because I was pretty young. I became national chairman of the Young Social Democrats. And one of my friends once discussed, you know, the fact that women were underrepresented in the Young Social Democrats, and he said actually the problem was the whole human race was underrepresented.
I think it's the same now.
Because we didn't have very many members. But I became national chairman of that, and then a big row broke out in the SDP, which is now arcane. It's a bit like Monty Python's People's Front of Judea.
Judea's People's Front.
Yeah. But I had that row, and I was on one side of it. I was on the Owenite side. And so in that capacity, I then became close to David Owen. He remains a good political and personal friend of mine.
Very well-respected statesman.
Well, he certainly is by me. I mean, he's controversial to a lot of people. Interestingly, just over this summer, I was reading A History of the Labour Party by Martin Pugh, which starts off well and I don't think ends all that well, but it's very good at the beginning. And I sort of thought, you know what, I think I understand David for the first time, which I really hadn't. And this is relevant to the Labour Party's future. David saw the SDP as a sort of replacement for the Labour Party, whereas Roy Jenkins saw it as a Liberal Party. And they split, really, on that issue. In the end, Roy Jenkins wanted the relationship with the Liberal Party. David didn't. And that still faces Blairites in the Labour Party. If the Labour Party split, which sort of party would it be? A Liberal Party or a Labour Party? If, as it were, Chooker and Mooner's Liberal Party or John Mann's Labour Party? It isn't obvious. So what happened to the SDP, I think, still does have lessons for Labour.
Yes, because in a sense it jolted Labour out of its hugely left irrelevance and arguably paved the way for New Labour.
But I think actually the main thing that paved the way for New Labour was simply defeat. And defeat played its role. Defeat played its role in the modernisation of the Conservative Party too. I think in 2005, the Conservative Party suddenly arrived at a place where the members wanted to elect a winner, somebody who could be in government. And I remember the party conference. I think David Davis was trying to appeal to the Conservative Party he recognised and knew, and David Cameron was trying to define a Conservative Party that could get into government. And all of a sudden, really, at the party conference, the party had shifted towards that latter view, and it took everyone by surprise. Lots of people think it was because David Cameron made a a brilliant speech, and it was a good speech.
Memorably because David, without notes.
And because David Davis made not a very good speech, and it wasn't a very good speech. But actually, I think it was about more than that. I think it was a shift in the political atmosphere in the Conservative Party, and that happened very quickly. Just like it happened quickly, by the way, with Corbyn. You know, you can't necessarily read that. Obviously, it's part of my job to try to read that. And, you know, in the Corbyn, I didn't actually at all. But now I've sort of tried to consider why that really was. But in the Conservative Party, I think I did.
Ian Dale has famously sat in that very chair, and he blames himself, frankly, for the failure of the David Davis campaign.
Well, I think he shouldn't. I think that what changed the leadership of the Conservative Party was that David Cameron seized the moment, and David Davis wasn't know the moment had arrived, but even if he had, I don't think he could have seized it. I don't think he'd positioned himself in the place where the Conservative Party was going. He'd positioned himself where the Conservative Party was, and that wasn't going to work. It wasn't obvious at all at the beginning of that campaign, and I think, you know, among things that David Cameron can be satisfied about is that he spotted and understood that moment. More than the rest of us, before the general election of 2005, those people who, you know, were on the centre-right and wanted to see the Conservative Party move, we used to talk a lot about how that would happen. And it was David who really said, it's going to happen by me running for the leadership. And that was, you know, impressive insight on his part, and also brave.
You obviously moved into journalism, but your first stage of your career was that in politics, wasn't it? As a kind of think tank policy one type person. Did you always think you'd have a career in politics?
Well, it was certainly the intention. I ran for Parliament twice. Once when I was, frankly, 24 years old, I couldn't drive. I was a ludicrous candidate.
I was 29 and equally ludicrous when I stood for Parliament.
I was in the SDP. I was the SDP's candidate against Ken Livingstone, actually, in Brent East. And I've got a letter at home from the Citizens Advice Bureau that says, Dear Mr. Finkelstein, it was very nice to meet you, comma, and your mother. and it was basically, I was, you know, sort of hopelessly out of my depth in terms of representing people. But then I'd ran again, much more seriously, really, in 2001. And the idea was to be in Parliament. But then, just around that time, I then was, immediately after the 2001 election, I began to work for The Times. And when The Times editor offered me the job, he said, I do permit you to run for Parliament again, because I don't think you'll want to continue in it once you've started working for us. And I said, fine, and thought to myself, yes, I will. But actually, he was right.
But what was it about journalism that tempted you then? Because you could have, in theory, gone into anything at that point.
Well, look, first of all, I'm an opinion writer. Okay, I'm not a reporter, and I don't think I would be very good at reporters. Actually, I might get the occasional scoop, but if I was like the transport correspondent, what I'd do is like miss the major green paper and white paper whilst getting scoops. I wouldn't be very good at, you know, I'm awestruck by the people who report, specialist reporters on The Times, just the discipline, the combination of getting stories, but also of managing to cover all the routine things and managing their diary to ensure they're there and all that sort of stuff. It's very impressive what they do, and I wouldn't have been very good at that, I think. I was always attracted to journalism. I wrote my first piece for The Times, I think, when I was 23 years old, when The Times comment editor had rung me up after a speech I'd made at the SDP conference. I think when I look back on it, the real reason for that was that the Labour Party was boycotting The Times at that moment, and they wanted some non-Tory voices. So I, you know, as in the SDP, I struck them as, ironically enough, that.
Yeah.
I started doing that, and I'd always been very interested in opinion journalism. I don't think I was particularly good at it at that time, but I had worked as a trade journalist. So I worked for a company called VNU Business Publications, which was
produced a PC magazine, as I recall.
I ran a paper called Connection, the distributed data processing fortnightly. It was the first, these were the first papers that were about the internet, basically, just as it was being created, because my MSc is in systems analysis, so I've been always interested in computing. And so I was in those papers, and I did enjoy, you know, I enjoyed journalism, so I thought to myself, well, that would be an interesting thing to go back to, you know, while I'm working on a political career. But actually, in fact, it took over.
Did you always want to be an opinion writer? Did you always want to be a member of the commentariat? Because like you've just said there, you didn't want to have a beat and go out there and get the news and do all the write-ups.
I just thought I'd be better at it. You know, I've always thought that I could do that job. I think it's more than just opinion. It's also analysis.
Awesome.
I think that I can provide analysis and opinion. I think I can, because I partly, I think working in politics has provided me with an understanding of how politics works, the people involved in it, of why they make decisions. And, you know, I've been doing it, been involved in politics since I was 16 years old. I've, in the first general election in which I worked for a leader of a party was 1987. And I can use that knowledge to, like anybody can use knowledge of anything, to illuminate what goes on. And I hope that, and I've, you know, continue to update that. And I hope, therefore, I do that.
Do you feel, in a sense, more powerful politically as a columnist, as an opinion former with a major platform like The Times? I mean, just being honest, I don't really care what backbenchers think either. I don't even really think what the shadow front bench think at the moment. But I do read David Aronovich. I do read Daniel Finkelstein. You know, there are a number of Polly Toynbee. These are people that I want to know what they think, even if I disagree with them. Sure. I want to know why. I want to put some thought into why I disagree.
Well, OK, that's true when you're talking about big political issues. So when you are a member of parliament, you can be influential in three ways, really. One is you can represent your constituents and your constituency on very specific issues, and you can really get things done. You can help individual people to navigate the legal or political system, and that is a very valuable thing to be able to do. The second thing you can do is you can raise political issues in Parliament and publicly, and if you're savvy about it, you can. They can be specific political issues, and you can do them at least as successfully, and maybe more successfully than you can if you are just, you know, writing columns. And the third thing, obviously, you can do is you can be in the government. So I had a lot of these conversations with Michael Gove. You know, we used to work together, and when we were on The Times, and we had a lot of, because I'd run for Parliament, and he was contemplating running for Parliament, and we talked about this a lot, about where, and, you know, in the end, if you look at Michael, he did really make a very big difference in education by becoming Secretary of State. So I don't think you could say that he'll do anything as a writer that will be as influential as that, and I wouldn't claim I would either.
Every school indeed has a Bible in its library, doesn't it, with compliments of the Secretary of State.
More, obviously, it's more than that. It's more the you know, the free schools programme or extending the academies. So
yeah,
it does.
I am a lefty. I have to make a few token jabs. But clearly, the platform that that gave you allowed you to lend support to the kind of so-called modernising agenda within the Conservative Party, the kind of Cameron, Osborne way of doing things. That was the way it was going, wasn't it? And you were clearly instrumental in helping that along.
Yeah. I hope I played a role in shaping it and arguing for it in every forum that I was involved in, both in talking to them and in writing in The Times. I hope that I sort of helped to make obvious what we were trying to do. I hope I tried, you know, I hope I gave Times readers an insight into what it was about, and I hope I made the arguments for it. That was part of, you know, part of what I saw my job as being.
How did you write your columns? How did you get the inspiration? Were they always drawn directly from the headlines? You knew almost automatically what you had to write about because there was stuff happening and you were going to opine on it? Or did you ever kind of draw inspiration from daily life? How does it work?
Well, I think it's a combination of different things. So you're always after, I think, one big, solid, but good, new idea. Actually, that's not quite true. You've got to combine two things. People like you to break new ideas, to give them a new perspective on, you know, what modernisation might be, or to help them understand, you know, let's, for example, say, to understand Jeremy Corbyn and the Parliamentary Party. I think one of the ways that you understand Jeremy Corbyn and the Parliamentary Party is by understanding that Jeremy Corbyn is not fundamentally a parliamentary socialist. And there is a critique, you know, which Jeremy Corbyn, I think, agrees with, that, you know, Ralph Miliband, for example, has written. And one of the things that I always joke to people is, you know, I read Ralph Miliband's books so that you don't have to. I don't mean that, you know, in a sort of bad way. I think lots of people have busy lives, and part of my job is to understand those things and to explain them to people. So I will try. Sometimes I'll try and have, you know, a really good new idea, but sometimes it's just polemic. So
or sometimes you read every single biography of every prime minister ever since the start. I mean, I remember reading that a few weeks ago when you wrote a column on that. It was very memorable.
I've completed it. I've 35 prime ministers in, so I've still got about 20 to go. Alongside having new ideas, people also like polemic. You know, I realise that when you tell people something they already think, but you express it well, and maybe you have some good jokes or good lines in it, people really appreciate that too. So you've got a mixture of those things. And, you know, in my mind, everything in a column comes from the core idea. You have to think of the core idea. And I spend I write my column on a Tuesday. So on a from Friday till about sort of Sunday, I'm all the time thinking about the core idea, whether I can cut. Sometimes I've already had one, and I'll noted it down from, you know, 3 weeks ago. And then I'll come and fill it. I'll be reading on it. But I want to try to identify that core idea, partly because then it means that if I do need to do any reading, go back to any books, find any information, I can do that.
Do you ever get kind of trumped, as it were? So you think of it, because it often happens with Sunday newspaper journalists where, you know, they come up with a great story on a Tuesday, but they're always worried that someone else is going to run it between now and Sunday. Do you ever have that with one of your ideas?
Yes, my brother-in-law describes column, who's not a column writer, but he describes it as column writing as being like Scrabble. Basically, you have to have the letters. You have to have the triple letter score as well in order to which to put it. But it also has to be your turn. And that last one can be frustrating, so somebody can do it. So occasionally I'll have an idea, and on a Sunday I'll write to the comment editor saying, just in case, I do want to do this particular subject. You know, Robert McNamara.
He or she should kind of bat away interlopers.
So if my colleagues who are regular columnists on the Times want to write it, that's just my bad luck. But if somebody send in a 500-word piece on spec that would spoil the entire 1,000-word column that you've got, then you at least want them to think, you know, do we really want to do that? Somebody's come. It happens actually very relatively rarely. It did happen the other day. I know what I was going to write about, the Goddard inquiry, and Libby Purvis had already written about it, you know, and that appeared. And then after that, I couldn't. But I tried to have more than one idea, really, so that I don't get myself into that position and I don't get worried if I'm in it.
How does it work in terms of how close you get to politicians? You're obviously famously very close to Cameron, but Peter Obon recently criticised you because, you know, you're regularly going to Downing Street, recording conversations, helping George Osborne with lines, all of those kind of things. He would argue it's a conflict of loyalties. But whereas I would say, as a reader, you're a Conservative peer, for goodness sake. I want you to be that close because I'm looking for insights and gossip.
He's had that criticism for a long time. And it's a perfectly reasonable point. I just disagree with it. In parenthesis, he occasionally makes it look different to what it is because he makes factual errors about his description of it. But so therefore, it sort of that does complicate it a bit. But let's strip it down. I think it's a reasonable critique. He thinks that there shouldn't be a meeting between journalists and politicians at all. And from that derives Peter's incredibly vibrant and outside critique, which I sometimes, when I read it, regard as entertaining. Having verve, sometimes right, sometimes wrong.
It's a colourful turn of phrase.
But I often also think it sometimes reflects a lack of insider understanding and is naive, and therefore often too certain of his own morality. That's my critique of his argument, but it's completely brilliant and it's done from his perspective. That certainly belongs in papers and it's why he's justly highly regarded. But I do something different. I'm very clear with readers about who I know and where I come from and who I am.
You might have some readers because of that.
But I'm hoping that I provide people with some insight that derives from that. And it's different to what Peter does. I would regard it having a strength of more of a realistic understanding of political decision-making and often more insight from the people that I know about how they think about things and what they believe. But obviously, when readers read that, they have to combine that with what other people provide, which is different from mine take. You know, I was a very interesting thing, because it's very interesting we're talking right now. This morning, the Daily Mail had a little pop at the fact that I'd done this work with David Cameron on his tapes.
Yeah.
And I'm very proud of these. It was my idea to do them. And I think, you know, probably when everything else that I've done in journalism has gone, we'll still have historically, hopefully for decades, maybe even centuries, this political record of a prime minister has never been done before. And I thought it was...
Is the book going to be My Journey by David Cameron?
Well,
he'll
do that. But obviously, we've also got this record, you know, which exists independently of the book. And it helps him with the book. It also means that he what he writes is kind of conditioned by the things that he said, because there's a record against which he can judge it and which ultimately, I'm sure, other people will be able to judge it. He has those tapes. They're his, but I'm sure that eventually there'll be ones that people will be able to reference, historians will be able to reference. And so I thought that was a very valuable thing. But the Daily Mail's criticism was that I went on Newsnight and pretended to know no more than anyone else about what the Prime Minister was thinking. Well, I hope I wasn't doing that, because I wonder why Newsnight would have me on if I did that. I hope that I was pretending to know, a lot about what the Prime Minister was thinking. And I think their point was to actually be critical of that. They thought that I should actually know less than I did. This seems like a very odd criticism, but I don't completely not understand it. So what the criticism is that there is no role in newspapers or magazines for somebody who is quite engaged politically and, quite close to political actors, because the role of the papers, and this is much more the case in America, is to be a sort of almost like a formal part of the Constitution. I don't share that view. First of all, I think it's ahistorical. So, as you can tell, it's something I've thought about a lot. I think it's right that I should have done. The Times has always had that kind of engagement. So, for example, Thomas Barnes, who really was the first great editor of the paper in the 1800s, was very involved in the Great Reform Bill. Indeed, it was suggested on in the House of Commons that Henry Brougham, the Lord Chancellor, was effectively editing the Times by driving them on towards a more reformist position, and the Times was supporting that. The Times has always had that. Or, for example, Robert Lowe, who was the chief leader writer, but also one of the great supporters of free trade and against tariffs and supporting a sort of Gladstonian economics. So the Times has always had that element to its coverage, less successfully also around the time of appeasement, which maybe we'd be less keen to mention, but it's also true. I don't share the American view of the role of newspapers. I think it's quite a pompous one. I do think it's important when you are a comment opinion writer that you're clear where your views come from, but I think that you gain an advantage of being well-informed. You can provide a perspective that people understand that helps people's insight because it reflects a proper understanding of your own. Of course, it benefits, and the paper benefits, from the fact that it has many, many people that don't do that and hold different views to mine. If mine was the only perspective in the paper, that would be different.
Well, that's why you read a plurality of columnists, as far as I'm concerned, because you want it to be challenged in different ways.
Yes.
I agree with much of what you write, but on the other hand, even if I don't, I'm going to read your column extra carefully to try and work out where at the point that we depart. For me, the substance of the criticism with the Cameron tapes is maybe the kind of news editor's lament, which is that you were privy to stuff that David Cameron might have said on tape that idle Wednesday afternoon, and then as the news was breaking on the subject on the Thursday, there were nuggets of information that you knew from the tape that you kind of were keeping back for the memoirs.
Yeah, I mean, I think I would hope that most of my colleagues on the Times would think that I helped actually with the paper understanding what he was trying to do, and I often sort of obviously talk to my editors about that. So I'd hope that people on the paper wouldn't feel that. But naturally, when you get journalistic access, everyone understands this, you do that under conditions. In order to do the Cameron tapes and diaries, which I had my idea, I had to reflect what he was willing to do. Otherwise, we wouldn't have been able to do it. I don't think the conditions were too onerous, but one of them was certainly that while he was doing it, people wouldn't know we were doing it. But obviously, it still meant that I was able to understand what he was doing. There weren't really, it's interesting because it wasn't really the nature of the tapes, there weren't really a lot of moments in it where you'd find that, the public record and what he was telling me are at great variance, even though he's frank and, the tapes will be, and his memoirs will be, I think, illuminating about his thinking. I found that didn't really happen. And of course, naturally, I therefore had a lot of access. It's what journalists work for. As an opinion writer, I think it was part of my job and is part of my job to be the person who understands and gets the best access, talks to people.
But of course,
you do that under certain circumstances. It's a slightly different now. So the position is slightly different now. When I began doing this, I was working as a member of the staff of the paper and I was executive editor. So now I'm actually in a different position. I'm now no longer employed by the paper. I'm much freer to do what I do. I'm a Conservative peer. So the relationship I have there is different, actually, than it was.
So what's your view of David Cameron at the moment and the position that he finds himself in? Because, he won an election outright. against all odds. I was incredibly impressed by that. It shocked a lot of people. And there he is, you think, well, he can abandon the coalition. And then he's got a full second term to do whatever he needs to do. And then within a year or so, he's out on his ear and recently stood down as a Member of Parliament as well. I mean, talk about a fall from grace, largely undeserved, in my view.
Well, yes and no. What David was so the traditional view of David, and I've written this, is that he was a, and I think a view actually, funnily enough, because I've obviously talked to him a lot about it, that he would sort of come quite close to himself. He's, you know, a reasonable person trying to do reasonable things who, you know, the critics would say too tactical, too cautious. You know, he would call himself moderate. They would say, you know, he was a wuss. You know, that, so you'd have that kind of debate. Actually, I think both of those views, his and theirs, are not quite right. I think that David was capable of quite bold gambles, and that if you look at the history of his premiership, they were one after another. You know, the platform from which he fought the election for leadership was quite a bold gamble. He didn't need to fight it from that position. He'd worked for kind of Norman Lamont and Michael Howard. He could have fought it from a position that was further to the right than the one that he chose. The position that he took immediately after the Conservative Party didn't win a majority, and you know, the way that he made an offer of full coalition to the Liberal Democrats, the offer of the AV referendum, which was very bold and unexpected and a risk. Obviously, agreeing to the Scottish referendum was something that I think he was put in a position of having to do so. So he did that many times over. If you do that enough, one of these times, and you put your chips, one of these times you are going to lose. Mm. And that's, I think, what happened. Now,
but lose so spectacularly.
Yes. There's obviously, you know, a debate over whether the referendum was necessary and right. I would argue it was both. And in fact, one of the things that's very odd is people make two arguments at the same time, but they don't recognise they're inconsistent. One of them is he didn't need to have this referendum. This is just like the narrow obsession of a few Tory MPs and also of UKIP, and therefore the referendum was unnecessary. The other one was it's dangerous to hold the referendum because the country might vote to leave the European Union. These two things are inconsistent.
Of course.
The result, which most people who voted Remain, as I did, as maybe you did too.
I voted to leave.
Oh, did you?
I did indeed.
Yeah, that's interesting. Not so much of a Blairite then. So the result of the referendum, in my view, vindicated holding it. I know that lots of Remainers think because the referendum was lost, therefore David Cameron was a fool to hold the referendum. But what British people voting leave meant was people really wanted the referendum, and they really wanted to leave the European Union. Lots of people were extremely critical of it. Now, in those circumstances, it strikes me as amazing that people would argue that it wasn't politically necessary for him to hold the referendum, and it was politically trivial, the amount of people who wanted to have it. That's not true. Tony Blair, I think, takes a big share of the responsibility for why we had an in-out referendum, because he promised a referendum on the Constitution, and then when...
Which is ridiculous, really. I mean, who wants to vote on a Constitution?
Well, the point is that he promised that vote, and then when the Constitution was defeated in other countries, he withdrew the promise when the Constitution turned into the Lisbon Treaty. And in doing that, he created a head of steam behind an in-out referendum. He could have had the referendum on the treaty, which I think people would have been content to have at that point. Not necessarily the case that you'd have had to have an in-out referendum, but after that it became necessary.
So we've now got Theresa May's Prime Minister. You're a Conservative peer. Would you accept a ministerial job in the future? How does it work?
No. Well, first of all, you can't have a ministerial job and be a political journalist at the same time. Not because of the political journalist then, but because you can't, when you're a minister, have other roles. So Boris, for example, has stopped doing his column in the Telegraph when he's become a...
Which I've missed, actually, because he was a good writer. He's many things, but he was always an entertaining writer.
He's a very entertaining, very good writer. So I wouldn't take that role. I mean, I have been offered it, actually, before. Not by Theresa May, but before the Conservative Party was part of the coalition, you know, it was positive to me that if they did form a government, did I want to be a minister? And I didn't want to do that. Being a member of a minister in the House of Lords, it can be very satisfying, but I'm quite committed to what I'm doing. I really love what I do. It's a wonderful job, and I wouldn't want to give it up for that.
What is a typical week for you? Because I imagine it's, you know, swanning around the Lords, amending legislation, and then, you know, popping on Newsnight at the end of the day and going on LBC and writing your columns. I mean, it seems to me, if I wasn't doing job, it seems the greatest podcast. Job in the world.
I really have a lovely job. It's really, really, it is very enjoyable. That's one of the great things about it. Weeks aren't typical, but among the things that I do, so I try to go into the Times, not absolutely every day, but most days, because we have meetings where the current editor, you know, basically holds sort of brainstorming, and we can contribute ideas, pick up the things that we've learnt, and in a kind of soft way or hard way, guide the paper towards certain either political stories, so I'm often sharing things that I know about or I've learnt, you know, by talking to my contacts or to friends or whatever it is to help, I might listen to stories of others and say, actually, that's not quite right, and add in, you know, new information. But also, actually, we have all sorts of information about other things. You might have read a story in an American website about people putting microchips in their skin in order to open front doors or whatever. That just was an idea that we discussed this week. You know, the idea is I go into the paper to bring in ideas, and I really enjoy it there as well, because we have a section of the paper which is for comment writers, and so, you know, I might go in and David Aronovich and Phil Collins is there, Oliver Cam's there, Hugo Rifkind. It can be
big hitters.
Giles Whittell. It can be very interesting, stimulating, and actually, you know, you learn. We had some really interesting conversations about Europe, about grammar schools, whatever it happens to be. We'll have a debate about it, and you're often well informed. We do come sometimes. We tread around the same arguments over and over again, has to be admitted, but it's very stimulating. And so I do that.
And does that feed your column, as it say? I mean, if you go kind of toe to toe with David Aronovich over a certain issue over coffee, yeah. does that then filter into your column, because you think, well, people like David would argue this, but you know, the retort is that, and maybe vice versa?
It totally can do. I mean, this morning's column, I was telling Hugo Rifkind this morning. This morning's column was where I wrote about Michael Foster, the Jews, and the Labour Party. It was slightly inspired by Hugo saying something about the fact that Ken Livingstone couldn't resist talking about Hitler, and that actually set off a whole train of thought. And usually it's because it sets off a whole chain of thought. Actually, you often write a column based on something you've said rather than somebody else has said, but you're playing off somebody else, playing off an argument. Mm. So I do find that a very valuable, stimulating, and I hope, you know, I regard it as part of my contribution to the paper. Obviously, you spend some time writing. In my case, a lot of time reading, though I tend to try to do that in weekends and evenings rather than actually sitting down during a working day and reading. But I don't know why that is, but because it is often work, but I don't do it then.
I think like that. I think if it's reading, you've got to do it at home because it's not quite work, even if it is.
Yeah. I know. Well, I've got myself a new office chair at home, which I can sit and read in it because it's comfortable enough. So I do that. I do quite a bit of speaking, sometimes to businesses. So I did a big speech to the British Council of Offices and their annual lunch.
So they literally pay you to do a turn.
That's right. And so you do some of that. Obviously, I also do a lot of speaking to academic or charities or Jewish organisations where I'm trying to, you know, it's the contribution I can make to the community. Often they're raising money for charities and things like that. I did a very interesting and fun session with Alan Dershowitz where I was interviewing him in front of a group. Doing precisely that this week.
I was at the Jews Care dinner a few weeks ago, and it was a couple of days before the referendum, actually, and Cameron was there. He was the keynote speaker. Right. And he just went on about you must vote to remain for about 25 minutes. Oh, and by the way, Jews Care are doing a great job. Thanks very much.
So I'll do that. These are just sort of some of the things I do. Obviously, then there's also the Lords. Some of the Lords' work can be quite specialist. So it's
and do you have to physically go to the Lords to do it, or is it that you've got a parliamentary email address and you can do it from home?
No, you can. Well, obviously, you know, preparing for debates. So I think a lot of the useful things that you can do as a member of the House of Lords actually consists of being able to approach ministers and talk to them about detailed aspects of government legislation which you think, you know, could be altered or changed or better phrased. And then,
how does that work? Do you kind of catch them in the corridor or the lobby, or do you make an appointment?
Well, sometimes, no, you can do any of those things. Sometimes you make an appointment. sometimes you catch them in a corridor. But the best thing about it is obviously you can catch them in a corridor. And so that's part of being in the Lords. And obviously, also, a week will always consist of, you know, like a PhD student who's doing some work on something that they want to talk to you about. Somebody who wants to know how they can get a job in journalism. That's often, you know, the point. Somebody who's setting up a new charity who hopes that they can persuade you to be on their advisory board. All those things also fill the week.
You're a prominent Jewish figure in public life. Have you experienced any of the kind of recent rise in anti-Semitism yourself? And because you say, I don't know this about the Corbynites. You read about it, but I've never experienced it. I'm not Jewish myself, so I don't know. But there does seem to be a problem with Jewishness in the Corbynite left.
I would say this. I think there's never been a moment where, in my lifetime, where Jews are as worried about being Jews as they are now, who are as worried about anti-Semitism as they are now. And that definitely arises from the left. And the reason is that the left conflates Zionism with Judaism, precisely the thing that actually they accuse their Jewish critics of doing. And that has been quite worrying. I wouldn't want to exaggerate it. I joked in a piece I wrote for the Times about the fact that on the Queen's speech day, I found myself sitting next to another Jew, and there were two Jewish people on the other side of the house, and one of us called to the other the sort of ancient Jewish conversation, which was, where should we go for lunch? And I was thinking about it afterwards. I was thinking, you know, while that is still the case in this country, you know, four Jews, so we always, of course, we were the ones that got the seats first, were in the House of Lords. Things are not, you know, one shouldn't be hysterical about it. We're obviously also quite sensitive. I'm a son of two refugees. My mother was a concentration camp survivor. And naturally speaking, I'm very sensitive to any idea that there could be a rise in anti-Semitism. And sadly, though I don't think that people who are on the left would regard themselves as anti-Semitic,
they clearly
in
are.
Reality, they do pose a threat to Jews. And in addition, of course, there's also a political argument beyond anti-Semitism, which sets Jews at variance with Corbyn, which is the question of the existence of the State of Israel, which most Jews, not all, but most Jews regard as essential to the safety of Jews over centuries. It was the reason why Israel was created, because literally after the Second World War, there were millions of Jews who had nowhere to go. And most Jews are of the view that to threaten the existence of the State of Israel is to threaten the existence of the Jewish people, even though I would never want to go live in Israel. I do accept that argument. So whether you regard that antipathy as anti-Semitic or not, it's certainly most Jews experience it as a threatening and dangerous development, that the left should have become so much enveloped with anti-Zionism, but also that quite a lot of people then develop conspiracy theories around that, so that they attached to Zionism, which is effectively attaching to Jews a sort of control of the media and the international banking system.
Ridiculous. How seriously do you think Corbyn is dealing with this, though? Because, I mean, clearly, you know, you watch the media and you look at the news, and he's failed to get a grip of this, even from a media management point of view.
Well, Corbyn doesn't get a grip on much. So one of the things that I would say is that although I think his response on the question of anti-Semitism has been pretty lame, so is his response to most things, because I don't think he's a political titan. So I think that to some extent, the reason for his failure to make an effective assault on anti-Semitism is just his sort of evidence of more general failure. But here's, I think it's a bit stronger than that. Jeremy Corbyn himself, you know, had a chat show on Iranian state television. He is, and has been for years, the leading advocate, basically, of those people who don't believe the State of Israel should exist, and who take an extremely radical view of the role that Zionists have played in society. In other words, comes close to the conspiracy theory that sees Zionist control as a general imperialist problem. This means that whatever he might be able to say about hating Jews, he still supports one of the leading trends of thought that represents a threat to Jews. And he can't disavow that because it's very important to him politically. He absolutely politically believes something which I completely don't agree with. Therefore, it's sometimes I think it's a bit naive asking him, you know, for stronger condemnation. He can condemn it as much as he likes. The problem still fundamentally arises that he regarded it as appropriate to have a chat show on Iranian state television, which, if you watch it, consists entirely of anti-Israel propaganda. Now,
I've never watched it.
Now, you know, frankly, the question of it's on YouTube. It's just hilarious, actually, in many ways, as well as disturbing because it's so poor. But the important point is you can then begin an argument, you know, is that anti-Semitic or merely anti-Zionist? All I'm really saying is that I think that a lot of that distinction is not as important as all that, because in the end, you know, if you decide that you want to drive out millions of Jews from their homes, you know, we can then sit all along and have a long discussion about whether or how anti-Semitic that is. Well, you know, to my mind, it's pretty anti-Semitic.
What do you think's next for the Labour Party? I mean, I've been a party member for 20-odd years, and obviously I've voted for Owen. Do we split again? Do we form the SDP too?
Well, it's interesting. So I remember getting to a point in the run-up to the 2010 general election where I no longer had a piece of advice for Gordon Brown about how to win the election because I didn't think he could anymore.
Under any circumstances.
So I tried, because one of the things that I try to do is to try to think for myself, you know, I have a political perspective, but to try to game through what should you do. You know, so just for example, you can game through for Jeremy Corbyn what he should have done to Hillary Benn, which is sack him at the time when the first reshuffle happened. I argued that at the time. I thought it lacked ruthlessness not to do it. And it was naive because what did he expect would happen? The parliamentary party wants to kill him and he has to kill them first. That's still the case, by the way. That is obviously not what I want to see happen because I don't support Jeremy Corbyn and I prefer Hillary Benn, but that's not the point. Unfortunately, the future of the Labour Party falls into the category of a problem that I do not know the answer to. So there are two pieces of analysis here. The first is this. I don't think a split in the Labour Party will work electorally. We have a two-party system. I'm not even sure, as I said earlier, what sort of alternative party would be created. Would it be a Labour Party or a Liberal Party? So even I think the problem of a Liberal Party is there are not enough Liberals to win elections, not enough metropolitan Liberals, you know, of which I am one, by the way. So there's not enough metropolitan Liberals to win elections, and you need a broader base. And the problem with Labour is that traditionalists tend to vote traditionally, so it's extremely hard to will be extremely hard to get them to part anyway. So I think it's intrinsically extremely difficult to see that working electorally. At the same time, here's the second piece of analysis. How does Liz Kendall, Chuka Ramuna or Tristram Hunt answer this question? Do you seriously want Jeremy Corbyn to be Prime Minister? And how can you be a Labour candidate if you don't have that desire? So I suppose my advice would be this. For Jeremy Corbyn, it would be to be entirely ruthless. The moderates in the Labour Party want to get rid of him. The Parliamentary Party wants to kill him. Him conciliating them and trying to all play on one team will not work. He has the wherewithal to defeat them, and he ought to set about doing that.
So it's the end of The Godfather Part 1, where he kills the heads of the five families.
The big weapon he's got is the ability to deselect them by controlling constituency associations. He has to control the National Executive Committee, and he has to win those selection battles in order to win control of the parliamentary party. There's no middle way. It's either kill or be killed. That would be my advice to him. The only advice that you can give to the moderates is don't split from the party, but don't support Corbyn for
Prime
Minister.
That's my position right now.
And you've got to find a way to muddle through combining those two things. These consist of a variety of extremely unheroic activities, avoiding answering the question, seeking to shore up your own constituency party so that you are allowed to answer the question in your own way, and they support the decision you make not to give wholehearted endorsement to the leader of your party. Do whatever you can to remain morally consistent and politically viable, and don't expect it to be a heroic path, because in the end, there will be a main party of the left. It will come good, even though it will take time. And then the other thing you have to do all the time is to try to organise in order to take back exactly the institutions that Jeremy Corbyn is trying to win over.
Do you think, though, when you look at the kind of recent results we've had in politics, the near independence of Scotland, the Brexit votes, the rise of people like Corbyn and Donald Trump, that actually this is evidence of a far deeper problem that, you know, I hesitate to use the phrase, but like normal people going about their jobs have nothing but contempt for the entire political establishment and any opportunity they get to say, you're all wrong-uns, they do.
People have always thought that. This is a really important thing that people miss. You know, I was really struck by reading about the assassination of Spencer Percival.
That's never been highlighted in a podcast of this nature before. I'm very glad you did that.
So in 1812, when Spencer Percival was assassinated in the House of Commons, his wife was in Great George Street, just around the corner, visiting somebody. In the period after his death, the square filled with people cheering the death of Spencer Percival. And when his murderer was taken to jail, they nearly overturned the carriage, supporting him over the people who'd arrested him. This was a period of great turbulence where lots of people disliked politicians. The Duke of Wellington used to, when anyone crowded outside his house cheering him, he used to point to his windows. What he was pointing out was that during the Great Reform Bill debates, people had broken his windows with stones because of the conservative stance that he'd taken on the Great Reform Bill and the mob violence against his position. There has always been a lot of scepticism and antipathy towards political leadership. But there is something that I think that's happening that is different, which is that as more and more people have become educated at a higher and higher level, and as more and more rewards have travelled to those people who are educated, because in a global economy, countries will specialise, and naturally speaking, our country will specialise in high value added, high education areas. A split is pulling apart between those people with sort of what you might call high human capital and those people with less human capital, and the parties are finding it very difficult to put that back together. You know, of course, one thing you could do is to have a political party that was sort of all, as it were, Remainers. I call it Romania, and one political party for Leavia. But if you look at those two countries, they're all split inside them. I don't think that's really possible. The sort of key task politically, I think, is to try to keep a coalition together, which the Conservative Party has always been successful at doing. And, you know, when you don't do it successfully, when you make an error, you're out. And that's what happened to David Cameron, actually. And it's happened to, you know, other people, actually. It's happened to Margaret Thatcher and to Teddy. It's happened to many leaders.
All political careers end in failure.
Yeah, well, they often end, you know, in the way that David's has, although his was a particular type, but Margaret Thatcher also fell. These are difficult, you know, coalitions are quite difficult to hold together. And, you know, you require the political imagination to hold together a sort of younger, liberal, multicultural, optimistic, a globalist type of person, and people who are more pessimistic, often older, maybe less well educated, in a single coalition. This is they pull apart, it requires quite a lot of imagination and a bit of luck to bring those forces together, to ride them at the same time. You know, and if you don't succeed, then you go out.
When Tony left, I was of the view that he was the first kind of prime minister that hadn't failed, that he'd left semi on his own terms and would be well respected. You know, he'd invaded Iraq, but we'd got re-elected for a third term. It all looked great. But since then, his reputation has been shattered. And I think as a comms professional, I think, has there been some complicity on his part in kind of just leaving the British media to it? So, like, for example, when Labour was trying to get into power pre-1997, we had Mandelson's rapid rebuttal unit. You know, any kind of slight on the Labour Party factually wrong was immediately defended and corrected. Whereas I think Tony's gone ahead now and almost said, right, off you to it. But look at how his reputation has been sullied.
Yes, he can't have worried about it very much, because he didn't do anything about it. You're quite right. He has what I call the Stephen Dorrell problem, okay? And it seems like a really weird way of putting it, but it's got a bit of personal history. So, you know, in 1997, after the general election, I was pretty close to Stephen Dorrell, the health secretary, and I thought he would provide a very good moderate leader for the Conservative Party. There were others who could do that too, but I thought he was quite impressive. But I always said to him this. I said, you will either get everyone voting for you or literally nobody. And it turned out to be the latter of those two. Either everybody would turn to somebody who would be like moderate in the Conservative Party, not as Europhile as Ken Clark, and which was, you know, couldn't possibly be elected, but also more moderate and mainstream than Michael Howard, say. And you'd either win the election from that position because everyone would come on side for you, or you'd get no votes because nobody would think you were their candidate. And it turned out to be the latter. But William Hague, who ran in a similar type of position, actually, for the leadership of the Conservative Party, although he turned out, he was a different leader to the one, obviously, that Stephen would have been. He ran maybe as a sort of more right-wing version of the same thing, right? So more moderate and mainstream than Michael and John Redwood, but also, you know, and more Eurosceptic, but less Eurosceptic, maybe sort of slightly more mainstream on that. He then won the leadership because, everybody felt, well, we can put up with him. Whereas the alternative to that is, well, we can put up with him, but nobody likes him. So Tony Blair has fallen into this problem, which is at one point, everybody was for Tony Blair. You know, I worked for the Conservative Party in the 1997 general election. I woke up on the next day and, you know, we'd lost everything, really, every seat. The Conservative Party had 165 seats. And everybody was thrilled that Tony Blair had become Prime Minister. And even I could see that it was, you know, a moment of change and a change that needed to happen, particularly with perspective, obviously, because, you know, I just fought the election campaign. I also knew it was going to happen. But at the same time, you felt outside the country that you belonged to because everybody was on that side. And then by the end of it, I did find myself on radio programs where it was me that was defending Tony Blair. And this was ironic because he had visited the constituency I was a candidate in on the last day to persuade people desperately not to vote for me. So it's an interesting feature of that moderate position that sometimes you get literally everything disappears and you're left with nothing.
What's your take on the Trump phenomenon? I mean, because it seems to me like scenes out of a badly written novel, really. You see some of the things he says on TV, you know, this phrase post-truth politics, but he gets away with things that any other politician ought to have been challenged on hugely. I remember he lost a case against his businesses and he said, oh, the judge was against me because he was Mexican. Well, if you look at a picture of the judge, he clearly, A, wasn't Mexican and B, was clearly born in America. I mean, and yet no one says, you're a total idiot to have said that. He just kind of moves on.
They do say that, of course.
It doesn't seem to stick, though.
It doesn't stick that because people who are on his side sort of regard him as a tribune for them and they're kind of quite glad that someone's sticking it to the man, really. I mean, that's what it's about. This is, you know, to some extent about people who sort of feel outside the political system and who belong to the category that I've spoken to. They're not the beneficiaries of globalization or ethnic diversity or, it was very good. There was a brilliant book I read. It was called The Hidden Agenda of the Political Mind. And it was all about how people ultimately vote for their self-interest. And they said, look, if you are a person with high human capital and you belong to a minority social group, then obviously you're going to be highly politically correct because barriers that are caused by social prejudice are the one thing that's going to stop your incredible success or based upon your abilities, right? You can, in a meritocracy, you'll be successful, but these barriers might be in your way, right? Maybe you've overestimated your intelligence, but whatever it is, that's your view and you'll become highly politically correct. If you are a member of a dominant social group, but you have low human capital, so you're old, white, no university education, more pessimistic about the cultural future, you are going to be against political correctness because it's not in your interest. Those barriers to gays or ethnic minorities or women are the one thing shoring up your income. And I think it's not a bad explanation of why arguments that you would think work, well, they do work with some people, they don't work with others. People have a way of turning around and filtering arguments that are inconvenient to them. The thesis of this book is, you know, that our brain is like the lawyer of our emotions. So there are people who think Donald Trump would govern for them and not for the other people. That's why they support him. Now, it's a bit more complicated than that because he's also captured the party and therefore there's quite a lot of residual support he gets just from doing that. People who would not ordinarily support him, but they do support him because he's a Republican candidate. The thing about it is when you're analysing politics, it's always a good question to ask. Who is it who benefits from this person and the things that they're developing? And that helps you sometimes to understand why someone gets support in a way that, you know, wouldn't. Donald Trump is directly against the interests of some people, but some people perceive him as being directly in their interests, and they will then find arguments to justify to themselves and to make consistent with their, you know, with their rational selves, their instinct.
What's your predictions for the future? And I know if you were clever, you would refuse to answer. But like, say, 10, 15, 20 years from now, what will the country be like? Will Scotland be independent? Will Andy Burnham still be mayor of Manchester, et cetera, et cetera?
So one of the things that I always do is try to talk about how to make predictions, because one of the things that I do is write a column in The Times on Saturday called The Think Tank, which is about football, but it's helped me with statistical thinking. So the first thing you know is that if you could predict the future, you'd obviously be a multi-millionaire, right? You can only do percentage chances, right? So you can't be sure. The second thing is, it's always a good place to start. Look what's already happened and then think about, therefore, what that pattern, what that means. The first thing is that you're right in thinking that you would be a fool to be too certain about what's going to happen, because it's extremely... there are so many different potential options. My view is that the electoral system means that the Labour Party will ultimately right itself, because there has to be an alternative to the Conservative Party, and people will, after they've lost several times, people will get the point. I don't think Corbyn support is generally actually Trotskyite. Some of it is. I think some of it is just naive people who think, as people are prone to in politics, they can get everything that they want and everyone will support them, but haven't worked out the fact that lots of people don't share their views and therefore they can't. And they ultimately, when they lose enough, that point, that penny does drop. So I think that was one thing that will happen. I think there will continue to be this pulling apart of the... educated and uneducated people, and the Conservative Party and the Labour Party will have great difficulty in resolving those. And the reason why it's difficult to predict who future leaders will be is because it all depends on who has the imagination to produce the political combination that can hold those groups together. I think Brexit will be quite painful economically. And one of the things about that is that I think the economy drives an awful lot of political thought, political activity, and it drives a lot of what people think, even when they don't know that that's the reason why they're thinking it, because the economy is absolutely critical. I think, therefore, there will ultimately be a difficult moment for the Conservative Party, even if it's not immediate, because I think the impact of Brexit will be somewhat down the road. Those are sort of, you know, some sketches of some of the things that I think will happen. One more thing, which I do want to say because it's a media podcast, I think it's important, which is that I know a lot of people also think there'll be a demise of journalism, right? And I really don't agree with that. I think that that new technology is one of the greatest things to happen to journalism. It means that we've got amazing outputs and we're not spending all our money on ink and paper. And obviously that means the money can go into the massive, diverse journalism. The Times has found that it literally can. It's not true that you can't sell to people. You can sell to people publications, and they will buy it if you edit it. And what we sell is editing, right? It's the collection of material. It's not just the comments. So one of the things where I set at variance to other people is I think that although there will be consolidation in the media sector, I think that I'm optimistic about journalism, not pessimistic.
Danny, we're definitely out of metaphorical tape now. It's been a hugely enjoyable interview. Thank you for your time.
And thank you.
A Big Things Media production.